I am here. You will never be alone. We are dancing for you. How would you feel to hear those words uttered over you as a preteen girl embarking into young adulthood? Author and professor Kutcher Reisling-Baldin's book, We Are Dancing for You, explains the value of Native feminisms and the revitalization for women's coming-of-age ceremonies to her people, the Hoopa tribe of Northern California, and we'll discuss their value to community, all people, and the desire to reclaim a balanced construct of masculine through the feminine in Native culture today on The Keenest Observers. Dr. Kutcher Reisling-Baldin is an assistant professor of Native American Studies at Humboldt State University. Her research is focused on indigenous feminisms, California Indians, and decolonization. She received her PhD in Native American Studies with a designated emphasis in feminist theory and research from the University of California, Davis, and her MFA in creative writing and literary research from San Diego State University. She also has a BA in psychology from Stanford University and is a 2011 Ford Foundation Predoctoral Fellow. Dr. Reisling-Baldin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for being here. I want to start out just by asking why you decided to write this book.
You know, I think it came from a lot of different places in my life. We didn't do this type of ceremony for a while. It's a part of our culture. It's a part of our history. There's a lot of reasons why we stopped doing it, most of having to do with colonization and invasion. But I think at a point, it became a discussion in our community that we needed to do something for our young people so that we could help them as they were growing up. And I had grown up with my culture and my people my whole life, hearing about this ceremony that we did for young women, and not really understanding the importance of it as I was younger and thinking about, you know, what Western culture told me about young women. And so when I was, we celebrate this dance when a girl starts menstruating, and talking about menstruation is not something that we often do in sort of generalized society, but it's something that Native American people, you know, were very open with and had a lot of discussions about and a lot of ideas about, and really it was about for them the empowerment of young women and showing them that they had important places in their cultures. And so when I was younger, I didn't really understand that, and I started menstruating when I was 12, and my mom sat me down and said, you know, we could do a dance for you, and we haven't done this dance in a long time, and there's a lot of reasons why, but I would find some way. I would find some way to do that kind of dance for you if you wanted it. And I turned her down. I said, no, that's gross, and I don't ever want anybody to know about what's happening to me. And I couldn't tell you where I got that information from. I kind of look back at the way that I learned about coming of age and the way that I learned about puberty when I was younger, and a lot of it comes from this place of that there's a lot of changes, but it's always very negative. Like when we talk to kids about adolescence, we tend to talk about things like you're going to start smelling, you're going to grow hair everywhere. It's never anything very positive. And so suddenly I'm confronted with, you know, in your culture, this is a positive thing and you should celebrate it, and I couldn't do it. And for many, many years, you know, there was a lot of talk amongst our community that it is something that needed to happen. And our elders were very clear that they wanted this dance to come back, that they wanted it to be a part of our culture again. Many of the elders that the women in our community ended up working with, they had made specific points throughout their lives to keep making sure that generations grew up knowing about this dance and this ceremony. So we always were talking about it. And years and years after, you know, my foray into the possibility of doing the dance, my mother was actually working with the women in my tribe to sort of decide how they were going to bring this dance back. And I was living in San Diego. I was in my 20s. And I was in a violent relationship with a man. And it was dangerous. It was a dangerous situation. And one day after a big fight, he left me on the bathroom floor, and I pick up the phone and I called my mom and I said, you know, Mom, I think I'm going to leave him. And she was like, you're making the right decision. And I said, no, Mom, you know, he's right. I'm nothing. and I'll be nothing without him. And she paused for this long time, and then she said to me, you know, Khadija, we should have danced for you. And it was a moment for me that I kind of understood why we did the things that we did for our young people, because all the research that I've done now, I've realized that adolescence is such an important time, and yet we don't have a culture, you know, in general terms right now that celebrates adolescence or tells young people the strength that they can have going into the world. We sort of focus on the negative things, and then what we know about what happens then is that during adolescence, young girls, this is across the board, this isn't just for Native girls, it's all girls, during adolescence, their self-esteem plummets, and young boys stays the same or increases. And so we've done all of these studies to show that the way that we talk about adolescence is affecting our young women everywhere. And there has to be something that we can do to push back against this negative messaging that we are getting about adolescence and young girls. And that's what this dance does. And so at that moment, it kind of became me wanting to tell the importance of that story. And I had realized that for however many years, we haven't been the ones telling the stories of our ceremonies and our culture and what it means. We've had other people from outside our communities do that in books or in studies. And now it was time for us to tell our story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have in a few remaining seconds for this segment. I want to most definitely take the bridge to come back to why you decided to do it. But in my own work, an elder of mine says we have to have rites of passage because we won't know who we are and how to interact in our world. I'm talking to Dr. Khadija Rice-Limbaldi, and we'll be back with more about Native feminisms and the revitalization of women's coming of age ceremonies. But first, a short break. Back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin. We're talking about Native feminisms and the revitalization of women's coming-of-age ceremonies with author Khadija Rice-Limbaldi. You're welcome to join us. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Baldy, let me ask you, what is the flower dance and why is it performed? And I know that's a very simple question, but you got into the real meat and contextualization of your work. And I think that we need to kind of hear the why of the power of the dance and what it means to the society, to your tribal society.
Well, so our flower dance is a coming-of-age ceremony, and what that means is we, at the onset of a young women's menstruation, take time to celebrate that moment of now you're becoming a woman, you're changing you're sort of where you're at in your life stages. And we do that in ways that pointedly help her to see her own inner strength and her own power. And so what we do is for 10 days, you know, 10, we put her into a space of ceremony. What the hoopas say is that at a girl's first menstruation, she is at her most powerful. So we look at menstruation as a time of great power for women, that within that time they hold in them a lot of luck. We actually tied it to luck. And we want to help them to understand their changing roles in our culture and society. And so we, for 10 days, go through a number of different activities with her. The culmination of which is a dance, and the dance usually lasts, you know, 3 days. We dance with her, and this is all the community, men, women. We sing songs over her. The actual name of the dance is not the flower dance. It's Hokit Chiswalte, which means they beat time with sticks over her.
Yeah, I thought that was beautiful. I have a nice question about that later.
Yeah.
I think that's an incredible phrase. I'd love for you to kind of explain what that means in construct, and definitely as it connects to like belief and construct and community.
So we do these activities with her, and a lot of it is about showing her that she already has within her the things that she needs to navigate her life. So she does a lot of running. Running is a very significant portion of it, and what the old one said is how she runs, that's how she's going to live her life. And so we're asking her to think about that she can make those decisions. Does she want to go fast? Does she want to go slow? And then we also do activities with her. We do talking circles. There's a lot of really important moments where we bring people from the community, women, to meet with her. She gets to ask questions. They tell stories about their own experiences with, like, menstruation and puberty and adolescence. It gives her space to kind of think about, you know, who she can go to in the community that's not necessarily just her parents, but that she has an extended group of people that care about her and that can help her because, you know, adolescence is one of those times where you can wake up one day and you just don't know what to do, and so you have people you can reach out to. I think that it's been an important way for us as a community to come together to show our young women that they are somebody and that there's a whole community that comes to be with them. And the girls that I talk to who have done this ceremony since we started to do it again have all made comments about how the people didn't have to show up. They actually, you know, they're like, we invited them, but they didn't have to come, but they all came just for me.
Hmm.
And that teaches them something about, you know, you're not alone, and nobody can tell you that you're not something in this world because you have had all of these people come and they sang a song for you and they danced for you.
Yes, yes, that's a beautiful thing. And once that orientation exists in a young person, there's, you know, minimal. My presumption is there's, you know, minimal chance that they can be swayed in terms of knowing who they are and how they orient themselves in the world.
No, it's true. I mean, you know, this, I do a lot, like all the research I do, I always have to say studies say because I've had to read all the studies.
Right.
But studies actually say, you know, girls' self-esteem plummets, right? And studies say that all these onset of, you know, detrimental behaviors like substance abuse or suicidal ideation actually starts at adolescence. It tends to be like 11, 12, and 13
mm-hmm.
that girls start thinking about these things. And yet, what the studies also say is to combat all of that is so simple. You just have to tell adolescents positive and reaffirming stories about your own adolescence and to help them through that period, and then it's fine. So it's something very important that they are given the space with which to acknowledge that something is happening, and then to discuss what that was like, and then to, you know, to know that there are people that they can go to.
Can you talk about that phrase, we're going to beat time on her, and the idea of what that means in terms of power and luck and the manifestation of identity?
Yeah, so, because one of the things I do in the book is it was really important to me that the voices that are telling this story are actually the voices of the women who helped to revitalize the dance and the voices of the young women who have gone through the dance. And because my thing with the research has always been, it's never been us that has been saying this is why this is so important. When I was talking to our medicine woman from the Hoopa Valley, she was explaining to me about the terminology. So Hoopa language, when we talk, our one word means like a whole sentence. That's just how our language is. And so the word for the dance, Hokit Chiswalte, means they will beat time with sticks over her. But she talked a lot about how it's about more than just the motion that we do, which is to actually keep time and sing. It's also about we keep time on her, so there's like times when they will actually like take the stick and beat time on her, not hard, just, you know, to keep the time of the music. And that it actually mimics the pattern that we're doing, mimics a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And it ties her then very clearly to, like, her own heartbeat, to our heartbeat. And she says we're kind of using her like a drum. And that drums, for us, that's what brings you luck. Like, when you want luck when you're gambling or when you want luck when you're going to go hunting, the men will use their drums and call a luck song to them. And so we are, in effect, taking that drumbeat, that heartbeat, and putting it into her so that it is tied to her luck and her power. And we teach her about all of those kinds of things as we're talking to her, but also within the dance as we're singing over her, she's able to see how many different people are there. Every time one of us starts a song, she can tell that it's a different person. She can sing along, and then she can take that song with her. There's many girls who have told me they sing those songs whenever they need something, like if they're feeling anxious, if they, you know, need to do better on a test, if they need help with something, the song will come back to them to kind of guide them in different directions.
Mm-hmm. So there's almost a reframing of not only the biological process of menstruation, but there is a reintegration of what it means to kind of have space to know your own power because of, like, not only who you are in terms of being a woman in the society, but just in terms of being a person integrated with other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a lot about, I mean, in my mind, the self-empowerment, the idea that the strength that you need, you have, and you just have to learn how to use it. So when she's running, we keep telling her, you can do it because you get to make the decision how fast you want to go, how slow do you want to go. When she has to stay up all night long while we're singing over her, and we keep telling her, you can do it. Like, you can, this is something you can do. And I've actually had a couple of the girls who talk about how they went to college, and when they were in college, everybody was freaking out about the first time they had to do an all-nighter and, like, stay up all night to write a paper.
Right.
And they said to themselves, well, wait a minute. I've stayed up all night while I was fasting after I had done, like, a, you know, mile-and-a-half run underneath a blanket next to a fire.
Right.
Like, I think I can do this.
Right, right,
so
right.
It just kind of shows them the amount of strength that they have, and it's helping to sort of guide them in that direction. So it's a time of, like, empowerment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm talking to Dr. Kutcher Reisland-Baldy, and we're discussing her book, We Are Dancing for You, Native Feminisms and the Revitalization of Women's Coming-of-Age Ceremonies. I am always emboldened by conversations of other coming-of-age ceremonies outside my own culture because they always, there's always a through line of rigor.
Mm-hmm.
That's a part of the process. And I think, you know, you spoke to it really well about, you know, seeing how you will orient yourself through the rigors of life. How have you seen or have you seen a difference between youth of this age and time acclimating to some of the old ways and integrating, you know, into transforming the ritual? Because, you know, it's not going to be as it was, but it's always going to be. So have you found some adjustment or acclimation or with the youth in terms of how they engage with the ritual?
It's been very interesting. I concentrated on the first 10 years of the revitalization specifically because I saw a very clear change that I thought was very important in our community, which is when we first started with this, trying to bring this dance back and approaching the young women, they all very much reacted the way that I did, which was, I don't know if I really want to do the whole thing where people know I'm menstruating and what does this mean, because we hadn't done one, we hadn't really seen one. At the end of 10 years, we had our first girl who was like, this is what I'm doing. And it wasn't that older women had to approach her and kind of like guide her and help her through it. She was very clear. I have seen these other young women that have gone through this. They are very powerful women now. I want that.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you got this shift that you have all these young women. And the example I always use is my own daughter. She's 11, and we've now been doing this dance for about 15 years, and she doesn't know a time when we didn't do it. So in her mind, this is just who we are,
mm-hmm.
and this is what we do. And so she's been planning for her dance since she was probably about 3 or 4 years old. She goes to them and watches very closely. She knows the steps. As she's getting older, she asks a lot more pointed questions about how does this work or that work. She's been planning what her dress is going to look like. Like, so for her generation and below, this is just who we are as Hoopa people. We celebrate young women. We talk about these things. Girls are very important. It's the same thing for our young men. They come to this dance. They participate. They sing. And so they have started to look at the fact that, you know, actually young women are very important to me. And my mom in the book points out, you know, you can't you can't think of a person as an object. You can't treat them as an object if you have come and danced over them.
Mm.
You just can't anymore. And so it starts to change how you view these young women in your life. And that's at school, and that's when you see them after school, that sort of thing. So for the younger generation, I think now there's no doubt that this is just what we do.
Right, right, right. Can you talk about the term native feminisms and what you mean?
Yeah, so, you know, I think for me, one of the reasons why it's pluralized is that, you know, tribal peoples are very diverse. And so to say there's a native feminism, I think, would be difficult because we have very diverse ideas about things and diverse cultures. But, you know, feminism as a concept, the idea that there should be equality and gender balance, that's a very old thing, a very old idea. And it's much older than the feminism that comes out of, you know, activism and what they call like first and second wave feminism. And so native feminism sort of talk a little bit about how our feminist concepts are really based on our cultures, where women and men were equal. And in a lot of native cultures throughout the Americas especially, women were able to hold rights to things like to own property, to marry, to divorce, to make decisions about what was happening in the tribe, to hold leadership positions, to be medicine people. And so our feminism is based on all of these very ancient cultural practices, but is able to sort of show how important gender balance is to any culture. So you have these old stories about, like, the Cherokee tribe, when they came to negotiate their treaty, they brought women. And they were like, women have to be here because they are also important and they should speak to what our treaty is going to look like. And the colonial society couldn't understand that. And they would refuse to talk to the women. And when they sat down, the Cherokee chief, he asked, like, where are your women? Because in a native culture, you have to have balance. And here are the colonialists going, you know, we don't bring women to these things. And he told them that that's why it would never work. Because you needed to have that balance. So our balance is such an important part of who we are, and our feminism is an important part of that, because that is what is going to make our culture strong and to make sure that we're able to sort of move into the future in a way, in what we say in Hoopa, in a good way, in a balanced way.
Right, I love that phrase, in a good way. And so you kind of also take from some more indigenous study this idea of rewriting and reclaiming and reconstructing. And I love how you put the re in parentheses. Can you talk about that construct and what that means in reference to what you're even talking about now in your last answer?
Yeah, so actually the re in parentheses comes from a good friend of mine. Her name is Dr. Mashana Goman, and she writes about the importance of revitalization, as in you're bringing back, you're recreating, but you're not privileging the past as if it's a utopia in which everything was perfect. You're understanding that in that recreation comes a lot of imagining and understanding of how it fits into the present moment and into the future. And I like the idea that, because we don't want to say that we are creating a ceremony, because we are actually recreating. We've had this since the beginning of time. Our ceremonies were given to us in Hoopa by our first people, who they are like our ancient beings who helped to create this place for us. And so for us, this is not it's a reconnection, not a connection. And we want to establish that, you know, our ideas, our epistemologies, our theories, they're very old, and we are helping to bring them back. In a way that actually, I mean, to me, much of what I've learned about indigenous philosophies and cultures is we were always a very forward-thinking people. We never made plans to not be here. We were always thinking about the futures. We were always thinking about how we could do things in a way that made sense for the planet, for the fish, for the water, you know, for the people. And so our philosophies are a way of helping us to understand what it means to live in this space in a good way. So we say, in Hoopa, we say no old, which means to grow old in a good way. It's one of the key phrases that we give to the girl. And what that means is you are you are understanding of your place in this world in a way that acknowledges that, first of all, you have responsibilities to everything, but second of all, that you can get from our culture a very clear idea of a lot of really important ways that you can help in a contemporary sort of like context with issues about like water and land and, you know, like how we're going to move into the future and be here and still be responsible for the places that we've always been.
Right. I think, you know, we have a few seconds left, and I want to get into that past and how that connects to the future when we continue. But you use epistemology. Can you briefly tell us what you mean when you say that?
It's ways of knowing. So the things that you, your philosophies, your the ways that you think and the ways that you know. It's one of those fancy academic words that we use. They're sort of like how we think about things. I always have to explain it to students.
Right on. Thank you. I'm Robert Goodwin, and my guest is Kutcher Reisling-Baldy, and we're talking about the revitalization of women's coming-of-age ceremonies among the Hoopa people of Northern California. Love to have your thoughts, but first a short break. Stick with us. With the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange, I'm Robert Goodwin with Kutcher Reisling-Baldy talking about her book, We Are Dancing for You, Native Feminisms and the Revitalization of Women's Coming-of-Age Ceremonies. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Baldy, I want to ask you a quick question. Is there a difference in the Hoopa folks' construct between rites of passage and coming of age?
I would say not necessarily, but we had a lot of different kinds of rites of passage. So you would have like a rite of passage when you were born. We'd have a ceremony after 10 days. You'd have one when you came of age as a woman, when you started your first menstruation, as a young man, when you were moving into like your next phase of like growing up into being a man. And then you would have one as you got older. So like we had a lot of rites of passage around marriage, and then we would do it again after you moved from, you know, adulthood into elder status. So we were always sort of marking different periods of time as rites of passage, where you had to do things to move into those next phases of your life, because we wanted to make sure that people, I think that's important. I think acknowledging that things are changing is important.
Yes, yes. And I think the action of finding, like literally not only those marks, but also what you have to expect in the doing of those spaces and time, I think is incredible in all cultures that do some sort of coming of age or rites of passage demarcation. You know that not only this is what you have to expect, but then this is also your responsibility and what you may have to endure.
Yeah, I mean, it happened when I became a parent. My mom again explained to me, you know, normally we would be in a ceremony for 10 days with this baby, and what in her mind that gives the mother time to do is like get to know the child and to get to remind yourself that now things are different. And it was very different in a culture where it was like I was in the hospital for 2 days and then they sent me home and they're like, go be a parent now.
Correct.
And so I think that there's something about taking that time to bring your community in to help you with all of these different phases.
Right. And I think, you know, modernity, if you will, kind of has, you know, had to, has definitely affected those traditional means of that acclimation process. I know even did a documentary myself on rites of passage in the Black male community, and how you know, my production team was really conscious about using the film form as a way to get to people, but also as a way that my community consumes content. So we were very intentional about using this modern form to give maybe some very primary lessons. In your book, I love how there was an explanation of one of the girls who had come through her run, and there was a picture of her with her hoodie, but with her bark skirt mm-hmm. on and veil on as well. You know, so I see that there's some conscious effort for you all in your community to make sure that you are dealing with what is modern, and but also connecting to the traditions as well and making the new.
Yeah, it becomes, I mean, there's a lot of things that we had to consider, and that's why I think we have to remind people, because they always think that when we're talking about Native ceremony, it means we have to, we're trying to, like, go back in time. But in reality, we're talking about how important this type of foundation is to in a very modern context, because the idea that you need to learn things like, you know, how to take care of yourself, or when to acknowledge that a relationship is toxic, or how to have a conversation about the type of person that you want to be. And so when we do the talking circles, the girls get to ask any questions that they want. They often ask about, well, what do you do at your job, right? Or how come you, like, you went to this school instead of that school? Or one girl really wanted to talk about, you know, what people, how people make decisions about, like, what to eat. And, I mean, just all kinds of things. So I think we're very like, right now thinking. The biggest thing that happens is they have to go 10 days without a cell phone or any kind of, like, electronics. It's interesting to talk to the girls about, like, the phases that they go through when they get their electronics taken away. But then also what they learn about themselves in terms of actually, you know, what it did make this difference for me or that difference for me.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I want to talk about the hoop of history and the chapter in the book that talks about history in California and the trauma to Native women. But before we get there, I found that incredibly interesting that a 12-year-old, and I don't know if I'm, you know, I've hit a certain time in my life, and I might have been a little ageist in this respect, but that, you know, the beauty of a 12-year-old being able to, like, navigate the difference of what happens when technology gets pulled away and really going and doing some real introspection on runs, or, you know, as they, you know, engaged in the bathing areas, or and then being able to reemerge into nature. I thought that was an incredible reminder that, you know, youth, you know, have incredible capacity.
Yeah, and it's really amazing to me how much of a change in growth you can see in that short amount of time that we're with her. It's very clear that they start to really understand their own power and place. But what's really nice is, so the image that's on the cover of the book is actually of a young woman wearing, it's a blue jay veil. And she wears it when she runs. She wears it when she's sort of, like, working with different things. And the reason is, we say a couple reasons. One of it is we're veiling her from other people who might look at her as she's running through the valley, because she's in a time of meditation and ceremony. But the other thing that the girls expressed was it actually helped them to only be able to see what was right in front of them and not to be able to think about how much further they had to run or what was going on the outside, because all they could see is the next step. And so they were like, this helps me to think about how I can think about things. I can take it one step. And I can go, and then suddenly I'm running 3 miles because I'm just thinking about the next step, not how much further I have to go. So all those kinds of things, they're pulling some very important moments for themselves out of, and that is to help create strong young people that when they go into the world, they know, like, I have the ability to do that. I've already done it.
I'm talking with Dr. Kutcher Reisland-Baldy about her book, We Are Dancing for You. So there's been some, of course, we know the challenge of settlers eradicating Native people. Why do you believe in the same breath that these particular traditions were consciously eradicated?
A lot of it is because, well, we were celebrating women. We were centralizing women, but also because of the angle that it was about menstruation. settlers couldn't handle it. I don't know what that is. It's a very different context in their culture. And when they come here to, you know, these spaces, and we say to them, women are important. We bring women to the table for discussions. We tell them that women get to make decisions about who they're going to marry, who they divorce. They get very upset for a lot of different reasons, but they really, to them, it challenges everything they think about the world. And women were very targeted, especially in California. Native women were targeted for some of the worst kinds of abuse. And so while Native men in California are often written about just being killed, and they're, you know, you're talking about an attempted genocide of, you know, almost 90% of the California Indian population. It's women and children who are, instead of being killed, are what they call taken. And they never really in the historical records talk to about what that means. But in California, we had a system of slavery for Indian people. So California enters the Union as a no-slave state, but it passes these laws that allow you to enslave Indian people. And when you look at the records of that enslavement, what you see is that most of the people who are being enslaved under these laws are children, ages 7 to 12, and most of those children are girls. And so really you're talking about a system of enslaving young girls to people, and they're using them for all kinds of purposes. So this dance for them, miners in our area would come in and say, you're obviously advertising this young woman as being available, so we're coming to take her. And it became at a point where if the Hoopa people were doing the dance, and because we were very public in this celebration, these people would show up and take that girl. They very much targeted these young women all throughout this genocide. And they were doing it as a means to control the group of people, because they would often go after the girls, and then this would put Indian people in line. They would be like, we can't do anything. We have to, you know, follow all of the rules because they will come after our girls. So it became dangerous to do this dance. And we stopped at a point. We weren't doing it as publicly. And a lot of, you know, if you read, like, histories or anthropological texts, they will say it's because we as Native people figured out that it wasn't okay to do it, that it was primitive, that it was backward. But they are not acknowledging the very specific ways that we needed to protect our girls, because it was girls that they were trying to take. It was girls that they were selling into slavery. It was girls that they were forcing to get married to settlers. And so our girls were really targeted.
Do you see the trauma of that time manifesting in present day? And is there a way that you all acknowledge it as part of, like, the community portions of the ritual, if so?
You know, I do think we are here in Northern California. We are in an area where there was an attempted genocide of our people, and it was not hidden. It was very public. And I do think that that stays everywhere. I mean, everywhere you go around here, you can mark a place where they tried to annihilate Native people. And my mother, she would go and do talks when I was growing up, and I would go listen to her, and she would always start with, you know, my grandfather told me the only reason why I'm alive is because some miner was a bad shot.
Hmm.
And we have to remember that. And he wasn't so far away. Like, he had actually grown up just after the gold rush, he was born. So he had grown up in the, like, late 1800s. And I knew him. He was my great-grandfather. So I always tell people, it's not that far away.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about them coming in and, like, taking water and rushing the villages off the side of the mountain, or setting all the villages on fire, or killing people indiscriminately, they would come into villages and they would set them on fire to make everybody run out. Then they would kill everybody and take the women and children, but not the babies, because babies weren't valuable to them. So they would also kill the babies, and everybody had to, and then, like, people who were still alive had to watch it. And so you know that that stays with the people, and that it's real. So when we're talking about revitalization, we're also talking about that it is a moment of us saying, you know what, like, you tried to completely get rid of us, and we're still here. And that means that we have enough power to go on. And how do we go on in a way that helps and that heals? And these things are actually helping us to help to heal from that, because how can you not carry that with you? But I also like to tell people, you know, we were very traumatized. It does carry on through generations. They know that. They've done all kinds of studies to show that. But what we also were incredibly strong and resilient people, and our strength and resiliency is what we also pass on through generations. Mm-hmm. Like, that's who we are at the heart and core of everything. We are a strong, resilient people who knew that these things would help us in the future. It's one of the reasons why I think every one of, like, the elders that you talk to would mention these ceremonies again and would say, don't forget, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. They knew that that would be the foundation that we would need to go on.
Mm-hmm. We have a little less than a minute left, and I wondered how you decided to do your work via the academy or the university and why that's important.
I think part of it was that I wanted to show young Native kids that they could also do that. I think writing the book, a lot of it is like, you know, I need to be able to say I wrote a book, but I want to be able to show the kids that the voices they have, the words that they have, matter, and you can, and they're in books, and people will read them and talk about them. Hmm. So I thought it was a nice space to be able to start to really talk to the younger Native generation about what they could do.
Kutcherizen Baldy, thank you for your time, and thank you for your work.